Welcome to the Sermon Podcast by Church of the Nazarene. Stay tuned for the latest updates and new episodes by subscribing. Find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Join us live every Sunday morning at 9 on our YouTube channel. For in-person worship, join our English services at Harrisonburg and our Elkton campus at 9 or 10:30 a.m. or our Spanish service at our Harrisonburg location at 11:45 a.m. Explore to celebrate recovery every Monday night at 6 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in.
Hey, good morning. It's good to see you here in person on 4th of July weekend. And if you're joining us online, we welcome you. Just a couple weeks ago, or maybe 10 days ago, I was at a conference of denominational leaders. We are a part of a greater denomination that's called the Church of the Nazarene. That's our local name as well. But there were a bunch of us that gathered maybe 10 days ago. And we had a speaker, and the speaker in the middle of the gathering, or right somewhere in the middle of his sharing, shared a story about an exchange student that was living with him, and she was an atheist. And he said that they would go around to different churches, and they would visit. He was a believer. The exchange student was an atheist. But they would go around, and they would visit with different churches. And when they were visiting, he said at the end of the service, they decided to meet with some of the leaders. And the leaders were saying, well, tell us what you thought of our church today. And the young lady who was visiting, who was an atheist, said, well, I'm confused. Do you all believe in God? And the denomination, and the church leaders were like, yeah, what kind of question is that? And she said, I don't remember at any time during the service you all talking to him. And I was like, wow. And he basically looked at us and he said, how much are you praying in your church service on a Sunday morning? Now, I believe that our worship are prayers to God, but I can't just get past that statement, and I certainly can't get past when I watch what's going on in our world, in particular in Texas, and walk up here and just act like, well, we're just going to... So I'm not just going to pause and pray for a nod and a wink. I'm going to pray because I was challenged about 10 days ago, but I'm going to pray because we see massive destruction, lives that are impacted. And I don't know how to help, but I do know how to pray. And so I want, before I start today, to just pause. And let's pray for these folks who are hurting today in ways that I can't even begin to imagine. And I don't know what else to do to help people in Texas today, but we're going to pray. So would you join me? Lord Jesus, you're an omnipresent God. And the same way that you are present here with us today in Virginia, in this local location, I know that you can and will be and are present in Texas. And all I've seen is pictures, Lord, and some stories and tears. And I don't know how you'll get glory from this, Lord, but I pray that you would. And we lift these people who most of us don't know, we lift them to you in trusting that you can and will meet all the needs. This isn't just a quick fix. Lord, we lift friends, people in our country to you, and we trust you for your healing, for your peace, for your presence in their tragedy. You understand tragedy. And so, Lord, today, while none of this makes sense, we just pause and we lift these dear folks to you. In your name that I pray, amen. Today we start a new series, and the series is titled Miracles. And in order to get this started, I thought that we ought to look at some stories that are more relevant miracles than just scriptural miracles. So I want to look at one that many of you in this room would remember, actually, in particular if you're north of 40. But it was February 22nd. It was 1980. This was Lake Placid, New York. And I want to share with you, this is what happened. Watch this.
It's a show. Now Petrov controls. Back to Parlamont. Skating in on the left side. Into the American end, 55 seconds, but Mikhailov has the puck. Mikhailov sweeping in, out in front, backhander goes wide, and Craig might have got just a piece of it. Mikhailov, that got the Billy Legendov. 43 seconds remaining. Morrow, checked into the boards, it comes back to center ice. 38, 37 seconds left in the game. Petrov with it, the Americans on top, 4-3. Long shot, Craig able to get a piece of it to sweep it away. 28 seconds, the crowd going insane. Karlamov, shooting it into the American end again. Morrow is back there. Now Johnson, 19 seconds. Johnson over to Ramsey. Billy Legendov gets checked by Ramsey. McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
Unbelievable.
So do you believe in miracles? That was a hockey game, 1980, semifinal game. Maybe you don't understand or you wouldn't care about sports, but this was the USA, who wasn't even sure they were going to play, versus the Russian team, the Soviets. And the Soviets had just prior to this Olympic series of games, they had just beaten our team, which is full of college players. They had their professional players playing. They had just beaten us 10-3 in New York City, in Madison Square Garden. That's essentially like winning a football game by like 100. So they blew us out. We go into the Olympics, which we weren't sure we were going to play. We were the seventh seed. We have all college kids that are playing arguably the greatest hockey team that's ever been assembled. They had won 4 consecutive gold medals. It was just a foregone conclusion. They're going to win. Why are we even playing this? In fact, the famous words that you just heard, "Do you believe in miracles?" uttered by Al Michaels, this announcer, which he's known for. He said on the way from the hotel to the game that day that he and his partner, Mr. Dryden, were having a conversation, and he said, we literally said, man, we just hope this is like a halfway of a game going into the third period, and we're only down by 2 or 3 heading into the third period, because everybody knew this was a total blowout situation. We had no shot, and yet in the semifinal game, 2 days before the U.S. team would go on to win the Olympic gold medal versus Finland, the U.S. shocks the world. 10,000 people are in the arena. It sounded like 50,000. And 35 million people later would watch this that night and literally lose their minds because we had no business even being in this game. And the U.S. wins 4-3. I suppose you ought to have a definition of miracle. So let me give it to you. This was helpfully constructed by our friend Brian Charette, and here it is. The extraordinary work performed directly by the power of God in our natural world for His glory and to attest to His word, presence, and love. Let me let that sit with you for just a second. In our natural world, what's the purpose? It's the purpose to attest to His word, for His presence, and for His love. Now, I know what weekend this is, and I'm not here to make anybody feel bad about this weekend, but you should know that as we get ready to launch into miracles, one of the co-authors of our Declaration of Independence, this man right here, did not believe in miracles. In fact, many of our forefathers were deists. They believed that there was a God, but that that God had nothing to do or wanted nothing to do with them. If you read not just church history, but history in general, you will come to find out that this man, born in Virginia, died in Monticello, who was a good man, spent the majority of his life investigating Jesus. And this is what he decided to do later in his life. The next picture will show the Bible that Thomas Jefferson constructed. The man who penned the Declaration of Independence said that the disciples were ignorant, unlearned men if they would choose to believe in miracles. So he constructed his own, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, Bible. And guess what he did not include in that Bible? He did not include miracles. He took 6 different copies of the Bible in different languages, and he literally cut out the miracles of Jesus. And he constructed this as his foundation. That's really sad. And there are many people, Christians and non-Christians, who don't believe in miracles today. And there are Christians who would say, well, we believe that they might have happened when Jesus was alive. We believe they might have happened in the Old Testament, but we do not subscribe to them now, today. Do you believe in miracles? Why or why not? Here's what it says in Matthew. Matthew records these words. Jesus went through Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria. People brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering with severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan, they followed him. Now, we're going to get into John chapter 2 in just a second if you're wondering where are we headed here. So it's the first miracle, of Jesus. And I've dropped my red and blue Gatorade. Y'all see how I did that red, blue, and I wore white? Okay. I was just seeing if y'all are keeping up. Weddings are incredible events. But I've had the privilege to attend many weddings. I've been in many weddings. And now I get the seat on this side as a pastor to be on the other side of weddings. But I want to share with you a catastrophic thing that happened at a wedding. So here's an incredible, beautiful picture. Last weekend, Ruth and I celebrated our anniversary. It was June 28th, 22 years ago. Wedded bliss took place in Easton, Maryland. This picture was taken before the wedding. We decided to do the pictures before the wedding. We were living in Jersey at the time. The wedding was in Maryland. So we wanted all of our friends who were coming from all over the place to not to have to wait to get to the party. So we chose to do the pictures on the front end. We get to the wedding. The rehearsal has gone fine. We've already taken the pictures. Like, we've done everything there is to do, and the wedding starts. All the groomsmen are in place. I'm standing like right about here as the center aisle is there. There are doorways in the back, in the middle. We got roughly 250 to 300 people sitting in the room at this church. All of the bridesmaids have now come down. The moms are seated. Are you listening? Everybody's in place. And if you know anything about weddings, you know there is one high apex moment of the wedding. Do you know what it is? It's when the bride walks in, right? And so when the bride walks in, everyone is standing. My aunt was actually playing. Bam, 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 bam. Those notes reverberate off the cinder block walls, and I'm standing there, and we're ready, and I'm already sweating, and no one's at the back. And the song plays through. And you know what happens next? See, everybody's looking back there, but then they take a glance because they want to see, what does the groom's face look like once he gets to see his bride? Second time through, bam, 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 she's not there. You know preachers exaggerate. Third time. We're now at the 5-minute mark. Now that seems like an absolute eternity. My friend, who is about 6'4", 230 pounds, is standing next to me, and he leans over and he's like, easy, big fella. And I'm like, that's not helping me. The minister says to the bridesmaid, can you go to the back and see what's going on? Everyone's still standing. It's been 5 minutes. They're now on the fourth rendition of Here Comes the Bride, only there's no bride coming. If I had more time, I would show you the actual video. It was 7 minutes. And Ruth and her brother, who marched her down the aisle, did not come for 7 minutes. And the reason she didn't come was I didn't know this. She had several relatives who were traveling who weren't there yet, and she said, I'm not going until they get here. Well, the rest of us didn't know that. I mean, that's a bad thing if you're at the wedding and the bride doesn't come down. 7 minutes of utter panic and sweat, and some of you in this room were actually at my wedding, and you know I'm not exaggerating that. It was a long, long time. And people are whispering, and they're talking, and they're like looking back, and they're looking at me, and they're looking back, and I'm like, she did finally come. And that right there, 22 years later, we're still together, which is a good thing. Yeah, you can clap for that. What happens in this story is way worse culturally. Now, you do need the bride to show up. But culturally, what happens in this story is an absolute catastrophe. Let's walk through this. On the third day, John chapter 2, verse 1. What is significant about the third day? It's the day, Tuesday, of double blessing. It's the day when God created, he said twice, the day of double blessing. And so for the Hebrew, they loved to have weddings on a Tuesday. The day of double blessing. And their weddings weren't just a day. Most of them were a celebration over a period of 7 days. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. This is about 5 to 7 miles from Nazareth. Nazareth had about 500 people. This was an even smaller pocket village, crucial to the story. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. And when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. This is like in our house when I say to my son, hey, I think Kobe needs to go out. The dog seems to need to go out. You know what I'm saying? Jeremiah, can you take care of this? Because I don't feel like doing this. The trash looks full, Jeremiah. His mom comes to him, and she's basically intimating to him, hey, they've run out of wine. She didn't tell him what to do. She just came and said that to him. Woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied. My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you to do. Do whatever he tells you. The woman here is not out of disrespect. The woman here is like, ma'am. And he's delineating his authority here, even though he is her son and it's not disrespectful. He's letting her know, why do you want me to do something about this? He's also saying, in essence here, when he says, my time has not yet come, it's essentially saying he's on a timeline. His timeline, what she's referring to is crucifixion. So right here at the very beginning, Jesus, in his very first miracle, looks at his mom and he says, what do you want me to do about this? My time has not yet come. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial cleansing and washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. This is a picture maybe of what they might look like. And because it says they're 20 to 30 gallons, I almost read it and interpret it, I don't think it's wrong, that maybe they were of different sizes. They weren't all the same. Fill the jars to the brim. So to give you a perspective, because I'm not sure you understand, how much wine is this? This right here, this is a 30-gallon drum. And you see that I have 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. So that's 25 plus 30. That's 55 gallons that I have here on the platform. He's going to make between 120 and 180 gallons of wine. That's a lot of wine. If Nazareth has 500 people and they're in Cana, which is a smaller place, I mean, most theologians don't even believe there's 500 people at this thing. I don't know if 500 people, we know it probably wasn't like that. It was probably 100. Can consume 180 gallons of wine? What are you doing, Jesus? Wow. I need to say a few things to you. Jesus doesn't turn the water into wine. Are you listening? To make the party better. He doesn't do this because he wants to sign off for all time for all people to enjoy the consumption of wine with no guilt. Now, you're in a church that this is what we believe and this is why we believe it. And whether you believe it or not, you're still welcome. But I'm going to just share this with you. People seriously and jokingly point to this passage and they use it as the justification of their alcohol consumption. There are ongoing debates about how fermented this wine that Jesus just made would have actually been, or if it was ever fermented at all. This much we know, it was not like our current wine. And it's certainly what was made was more amazing than what they even thought was possible. We're not interested in this story and what's the percentage proof of alcohol in this that Jesus created. At face value, though, we take it that it was wine. Jesus doesn't use his power to increase the chances here that people would get hammered at a party. It's quiet. Scriptures from the beginning to end, they hold very consistent prohibition to intoxication. And it says, instead, be filled with the Spirit. Jesus' actions here don't contradict those teachings. In addition to the witness of scriptures, our lived experience with loved ones, friends, neighbors, we have seen, are you listening, the devastating effects of alcohol. You've seen it, and I've seen it. Most of us sitting in this room have relatives who have had issues, problems, addictions related to alcohol. So how should we approach any drink? We should approach it, as Scripture says it, with extreme caution and the respect for its power. Our church actually, maybe you didn't know this, actually takes a position of total abstinence from alcohol. We believe it's the most faithful response that we can have as Jesus' sanctuaries. We do not believe that if you have a glass of wine, it keeps you out of heaven. That's not what we believe. But we don't back off of saying the reason that we believe this is because we've watched the devastation that it has had on lives over and over and over. Now listen to me. Some of you are upset with me right now, maybe. Just last night at 9:30, I got a text message, and it was from a friend. And that friend said to me, basically, what are you talking about tomorrow? The whole message is not on alcohol, by the way. And in the third text message that came, he stated the painful effects that alcohol is wreaking in his family right now. You can disagree with our position, and surely you're most welcome to do that, but we do commit to take it seriously. Verse 8, then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. And they did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water because it had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside. And he said, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after. The guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of signs through which he revealed his glory. Why did Jesus do this? Here it is. and his disciples believed in him. At this point, miracle number one, there are 37 in the New Testament that Jesus is involved in. Jesus chooses this to be the announcement, basically, of his I'm God. And there's only five disciples present. The rest haven't even been called yet. But the reason, in large measure, he does this is to glorify his Father and to tell them so that they would believe in him more. They must have believed in him some way because they were already following him. The disciples saw Jesus do many other miraculous signs in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written. Hey, are you listening? These, are you reading? Are you listening? These are written so that you would continue to believe that Jesus is who he says he is. Who does he say he is? The Messiah. And that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name. This is the first of eight signs, as John calls them in his book. And it's fitting that Jesus chooses to do this at a wedding. He's re-emphasizing his belief in a covenant wedding. Jesus is invited to the party. I love that. And he shows up. And he doesn't just blink and go, poof, bow. I mean, he could have done anything he wanted to perform this miracle. And think of what we just read through. Think of how he does this miracle. He takes the ordinary and he makes it extraordinary. He takes what's already there and he blesses it and he makes it so much better. And what I love is, it's sort of like what he did with the five loaves and two fish. He does it in such overabundance and extravagance. It's a simple, it's a sample of his grace. When he gets involved, it's so over the top. People can't help but be moved and touched and blessed by what he's doing. I think my favorite part in what you're going to see over the next month is how often, are you listening? Jesus invites us, humans, to be a part of the miracle. Do you really think that he needed them to carry it? Do you really think he needed the water to be filled to the brim? Do you really think he needed to do any of that? I mean, why didn't he just like, you know, poof, and everyone at the party automatically look in their glasses and it was filled with new wine? But Jesus, quietly, humbly, involves others so that we would believe. And he invites us in these miracles to participate. Not because the disciples or the servants did anything. They just were invited to participate. Wow. You know, there were miracles before Jesus. Think about this. Creation is a miracle. The flood was a miracle. The parting of the Red Sea was a miracle. The walls at Jericho was a miracle. Elijah and the fire on Mount Carmel, that was a miracle. Jesus fed 5,000, that was a miracle. Jesus walked on water, that was a miracle. Jesus raised a man from the dead, that was a miracle. Jesus saves this groom the embarrassment. And the groom did nothing to deserve this. Nothing on his own merit. Jesus just shows up and lavishes his grace on this whole thing. Do you believe in miracles? Billy Graham said this, God is not limited, and he is certainly able to work in miraculous ways today, just as he did in biblical times, if he so chooses. Our church tradition would say this, we believe in the biblical doctrine of divine healing, and we urge people to offer the prayer of faith for the healing of the sick. We also believe, thank goodness, that God heals through the means of medical science. He'll do both. This is their interpretation of what happened in this scene. And nobody really knows the moment that that water changed. This is the Chosen's version of what happened. But it's beautiful. You just heard it. You just read it. Now watch it.
Everyone, please step outside. Just for a moment, Thomas. Once you make that first cut into the stone, it can't be undone. It sets in motion a series of choices. What used to be a shapeless block of limestone or granite begins its long journey of transformation. And it will never be the same.
I'm ready, Father.
Some out and serve it to the master of the banquet.
These pots, stone pots, they were used for ceremonial cleansing of the hand and the feet by the Jews. So can you imagine all the people who have showed up and what was in those pots when Jesus shows up to perform this miracle? It's a significant miracle because, in essence, what he's saying, are you listening, is I'm not interested anymore in a ceremonial outside cleansing of your hands and your feet. I've come to cleanse from the inside out. And the wine that I'm going to create and what I offer is an inward cleansing. The Jew would have taken the clay pots in those moments and they would have discarded them, destroyed them, and thrown them away. These were stone pots. And Jesus says, I'm just going to take these, you guys fill them, and I'm going to recreate in these pots something new. Stand with me. Today is the perfect day, a great day, to offer folks a chance to come and receive, really, the second communion. It's what Jesus does. We're going to just play here just for about a minute, and then we're going to sing together. I want you to come and receive the communion. Take it back to your seats and just hang on to it. In fact, you can even sit down if you want. But we're going to worship and we're going to sing and we're going to stop midway through this song and we're going to receive communion together. And then I'm going to invite you to respond in a different way today. So hang on to your cup. Anybody in the room is invited. If you've turned from sin and you've turned to Him, you don't have to be a member of this church and you just want to be a participant today in our communion, come and get it. Take it back to your seat. You can sit or stand, whatever you want to do, and we're going to sing, and then we're going to stop in the middle of the song and pause, and we'll take it together. And then I'll give you a chance to respond. Before you move, listen to these words, because you're going to sing them, and I hope you sing them from your gut, whether you know the song or not. When did I start to forget all the great things you did? When did I throw away faith for the impossible? How did I start to believe you weren't sufficient for me? Why do I talk myself out of seeing miracles? Wow, how about those words? You are more than able. You're going to have to declare this. You are more than able. You are more than able. Who am I to deny what the Lord can do? You, Jesus, are more than able. I want you to come in and receive it. Hang on to it. Take it back to your seat. And then we're going to take it together. Come. There's tables all around the room.
Thank you for tuning in today. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button to stay updated on our latest episodes. If you have any questions about our church or ministry, feel free to reach out to us via email at info@cotnaz.org.